Okay, let's try to find our seats if we could, so we can take the best opportunity of the time that's been afforded us. And that includes you, Greg. All right. As soon as Greg quiets down, we will resume here. He still hasn't heard me. All right. Thank you. Well, let's turn it back over to Dr. Krueger for part two. How many are looking forward to part two? This will be good. We've covered some of this already in our church, but it'll be good to get more details fleshed out.
All right. Welcome back. It's always nice when your pastor calls you out from the front by name, when you're chit-chatting. That's always a good motivation to make sure you're behaving yourself and back on time. All right, I'm excited about this second session with you tonight. Remember, we're talking about the three major attacks on the Bible. It's historicity. We talked about that in the first session, narrowly focusing on the Gospels. Second, the transmission, which we're getting ready to tackle now. And then in the morning, I'll say more about canon and the misconceptions that surround canon, how our Bible, particularly the New Testament, again, was put together and assembled, and how those decisions were made and when they happened. So that's going to be all part of our weekend together. Right now, though, I want to talk about this issue of the transmission of the New Testament text. And I want to begin by sort of a little bit of my own story to start us out here autobiographically. So I get asked a lot when I travel and speak, you know, how did you get interested in these topics? I mean, apocryphal gospels and New Testament canon and what's called textual criticism, which we're getting ready to dive into now. It all actually begins my freshman year in college. I'm from North Carolina, as many of you know, and when I was a freshman, I found myself at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And I'd grown up in a Christian home and had a good youth group and was a believer and wanted to follow Christ in college, and I had received all kinds of advice about how to make sure I didn't lose my way at the university setting, and I tried to take that advice seriously. And when I got to college, I figured, hey, you know, I grew up in a Christian home and had a good church. I feel as ready as anyone could be for what I'm getting ready to experience here. And in some ways, I was ready. But I found myself in a university religion class as a freshman, and I found out that in many ways I was not ready, and not even close to ready. When I was a freshman, I had to take a religion class as part of the repertoire of general ed at UNC. And so I had to go pick some religion class to check the box in my, you know, sort of general ed requirement. So I'm flipping through the catalog. Yes, this is back when we had physical catalogs. And I saw a class called Introduction to the New Testament. Great. So I found myself on the very first day in this class called Introduction to the New Testament. Didn't take long to realize that the professor had an eye towards evangelicals and that he was lecturing in such a way that he sort of indicated, I used to be one of you. I used to think what you thought. I used to believe what you believed. I used to think the Bible was inspired. I used to think it was from God, and I used to think this and that. But then I went and got a PhD, and I realized none of that's true. And this class is basically going to be about all the problems with the New Testament. And he started going through the list, right, that the Bible is filled with forgers who pretend to be authors they're not, that the gospel accounts are filled with stories that are fabricated and made up, that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John contradict each other and don't mesh together. And on he went in this litany of attacks. And I thought to myself, what have I gotten into this semester? But then he came to the argument that was his favorite. And it was obviously his favorite because he seemed to perk up every time he brought it up, which is the real issue isn't even all the things I just told you. The real issue isn't whether the Bible contradicts itself or whether it's historically reliable or whether it's been fabricated, because we don't actually even have it. We don't actually have the words of the New Testament in order to even make those declarations, because the Bible has been so corrupted, so changed, so altered in its transmission history that you could never really know what it said And so all of our discussions about this or that are all sort of, to some extent, irrelevant because we actually don't have a New Testament text that gives us any reason to think it was what was written in the first century. We just have copies of copies of copies of copies of copies of copies of copies, all of which have been changed thousands and thousands of times. In fact, Ehrman said in class, that maybe upwards of 200,000 to 400,000 textual variants in our New Testament textual tradition. Now, at the time, I was, 19 years old, 18 years old, sitting in a university class thinking, "What? I've never heard this before. I'd never heard of any of this before. I never heard of any of the things he was bringing up. This was all brand new to me. And this idea about textual variations was particularly brand new to me. And I thought, I'd been good if someone had told me about that ahead of time, if I had gotten someone to give me a little bit of a heads up on some of these things ahead of time. And this is the realization that what I thought I was ready for, I wasn't really ready for. Which, sidebar, is why I wrote my book, Surviving Religion 101, which is about helping college students get ready for those sorts of things. Or high school students who are almost headed to college get ready for these sorts of things. But I wasn't ready. And so I began to wonder, maybe everything I've ever believed is just a lie. Maybe it's just not true at all. And if you've ever had that moment in your Christian life where you just sort of wake up at a moment and think to yourself, maybe I'm the one that's wrong. Maybe everything is just false. Maybe all the critics are actually right. And you have that sort of queasy feeling in your stomach where you're like, wow, maybe I'm as deceived as anyone could possibly be. So I had that sort of critical moment. I was like, what am I going to do here about this? As was said in the introduction, that professor's name, as I've already indicated, was Bart Ehrman, who now has written over 30 books in the field of New Testament. And his most famous and the New York Times bestseller that really put him on the map was the one written about this topic. You've probably heard the title. It's called Misquoting Jesus. And now the misquoting Jesus thing has sort of been his mantra. By the way, if you can write a book on textual criticism that becomes a New York Times bestseller, that is accomplishing something, I've got to say. Now, it's a lot easier to get yourself as a New York Times bestseller when your argument is that you can't trust anything it says. Because if I were to write a pop book on text criticism and tell you you could trust everything it says, once again, it wouldn't sell probably nearly as many. But nonetheless, it was quite an accomplishment to sell that many books. When I had him as a professor, of course, he was brand new. Maybe 30 years old when I had him as a professor. And he just retired, by the way, in December, 3 months ago. So now he's officially retired but still busy on the speaker circuit. And the thing he talks about most of the time is this. And the thing I get most of the questions about is this. What do we do with all the changes and corruptions of scribal variations in the New Testament? Are there really 400,000 of them? By the way, if there are 400,000 textual variants, that's more words than there are in the entire New Testament. The whole New Testament has 130,000 words, roughly. So we have more textual variants, three times plus more than just than all the words in the New Testament. Now, as you can imagine, when you use shock value numbers like that, you probably aren't getting the whole story. And I can tell you, you're not getting the whole story. And so what I want to do in this session is to respond to those claims. Is it true that the New Testament is wildly corrupt? Is it true that we have really no confidence in the New Testament text? Is it true that we really can't know what the original writer said? Here's one of the things I have to say, because I'm getting ready to respond to that and obviously say none of that's the case. In fact, I think we have tremendously good textual tradition for the New Testament. I'm a little amazed that Ehrman has made this his key argument, because I think it's his weakest argument. Other arguments he makes at least have some punch to them. I mean, I don't agree in the end, but I mean, at least he's trying to get somewhere, and he has something to say that I think is challenging for us. This actually is, ironically, where our best evidence is. So I'm still a little confused why this is where he spends most of his time. I've got to believe it's probably due to the way statistics can be used to make things sound a lot worse than they really are. But to those in the field, realize actually that the text critical side is where we shine. So it's far from being a hole in our system. It's actually one of its greatest strengths, which, of course, when I was 19-year-old sitting in the class, I never knew that. But one of the things I did when I was there is I decided, surely these aren't new questions that are being asked. Surely these are not challenges that had never been heard before. So I'm going to go out and find out if someone's tried to answer these before. And I discovered that they had been answered before and answered many times before and answered quite well. And we never got any of those, quote, answers in the class because he wasn't interested in answers. He was interested more in questions and leaving people with questions. All right, so how are we going to respond to this? How are we going to analyze whether our textual tradition is reliable when he says it's not? Well, this is a massive field called textual criticism. I've written on this field in lots of different spaces and lots of chapters and books and sections and journal articles, and we won't be able to deal with everything that can be dealt with. But if you want to assess the textual reliability of any document of antiquity, leave aside whether it's the New Testament or not, there's three factors that have to come into play. And we're going to look at those exact same three factors. What are those factors? You want to ask about the quantity of the manuscripts that you have of that document, the date of those manuscripts, secondly, how early they are, and thirdly, the quality of those manuscripts. How carefully have they been copied? So quantity, date, and quality. Like I said, this is a trio that applies to any document of antiquity. If we were looking tonight at Tacitus's Roman history, which I'm sure you're glad we're not looking at tonight, or there may not have been anybody in the room who cares anything at all about what Tacitus wrote about the history of Rome, published around 100 AD, so you know slightly after our New Testament was completed, but not by much. Tacitus's Roman history is actually where we get quite a bit of information about the unfolding of the early years of the empire. And if I were here talking about whether we can trust what Tacitus wrote, I would ask the same three questions. How many copies of Roman history do we have? How early are those copies compared to when it was published? And what do we see within the copies in terms of their comparisons with one another? How much have they been altered and changed? And do I have any evidence that the scribes knew what they were doing? By the way, one of the sub-arguments that Ehrman makes is that scribes in the Christian space didn't know what they were doing. He makes the argument, not merely do we have all the textual variations themselves, but we have evidence that scribes were inept and incompetent and unprofessional, and even goes as far as to claim at one point that the scribes sometimes couldn't even read. They were completely illiterate when they were copying the New Testament. I'm going to challenge all those things. I think our evidence for a scribal infrastructure is actually pretty remarkable. Again, we only have a limited amount of time tonight to work through this. Okay, so let's talk about those three things I mentioned as it pertains to the New Testament, and we begin with the quantity of manuscripts. When you do an analysis of any document of antiquity, quantity is where it all begins. How many copies do I have of the book I'm trying to analyze? For text critics, copies matter, and they matter a lot. If you're laying out your dream, like what would be the best thing, you'd want many as possible of copies of any text. Why? Why is it important that you have multiple copies of any manuscript? Because the more copies you have, the more you can compare them. And when you can compare them, you can see how stable the text is. I mean, just think about it for a moment. Let's imagine that we're analyzing the Gospel of Luke, and all I have is one copy of Luke. One. Now, it might be a reliable copy. It might be a very unreliable copy. How would I know? If I wanted to take this copy of Luke and ask, is it a trustworthy copy, what am I comparing it to? Answer, nothing, because I only have one copy. If I have more than one copy, I can at least say, well, I've got two copies of Luke. How faithful is tradition? What if I have 5 or 50 or 500? The more copies, the better in it comes to any particular document in the ancient world. One of the things you have to realize in the ancient world, of course, is that copies are hard to come by. Their manuscripts are easily destroyed. The two types of material that our manuscripts were copied on in the ancient world were papyrus, of course, on the one hand, and what's called parchment or vellum on the other hand. So you have basically plant material made out of the reeds of the Nile and papyrus, or animal skins usually made from sheep, but sometimes calves and things like this. And these things decayed. They rotted. Insects ate them. They were burned. They were destroyed. They were crushed and wiped out by foreign armies. We never have as many as we wish. Of all the millions of documents that were published in the ancient world, we wish we had. Maybe we have only a small smidgen of. This is particularly interesting when you think about where we find our copies, because one of the things that's the quickest thing to destroy any document in the ancient world is moisture. If you have humidity, your document has a very short lifespan. It just is going to literally rot away. And so no surprise that most of the documents that we find in the sands of Egypt, of any ancient books, tend to be in the sands of Egypt, because that's the driest place you could have when it comes to finding documents in the ancient world. So if we were going to look at documents from about the same time period of the New Testament, what would count as a lot of copies? Well, let's go back to Tacitus for a moment. How many copies do we have of his Annals of History, which basically date from about the same time as the New Testament? The answer is we have about three. Jewish War, which is written by Josephus, about the same time, a little bit earlier. We have around 50, which is really good for a document that's 2,000 years old. And I would say that the average is somewhere around 10 or 20. If you have a document that was published in the first century, how many copies do you expect to have through entire history of that book before the printing press, up to the 14th century? How many copies do you expect to have? Well, if I had 10, I'd be pretty happy. If I had 20, I might be doing cartwheels as an ancient historian. If I had 50, I would think I struck gold. Because you just have to understand how copies were destroyed and lost. We just don't have that many for obvious reasons. Over time, they have all kinds of things that can harm them and destroy them. Here's where we come to the New Testament. When we come to the New Testament, we are sitting on an embarrassment of riches. We have over 5,700 copies of the New Testament today and counting. This is a mind-blowing number. It's the kind of number that you don't even really have a way to wrap your mind around. We have so many more copies of the New Testament of any ancient document. There's no ancient document even comes close to the New Testament in terms of the total number of copies extant of it. So when it comes to our manuscript tradition, here's what I want you to realize. We have the best evidence to work with. If you can make a conclusion about the New Testament's transmission, you can be pretty sure that whatever conclusion we reach is pretty reliable because we have so many copies to compare over so much a span of time. And so this is a remarkable thing to observe. By the way, you may not realize that we're still discovering copies of the New Testament today. I tell my students about the most famous archaeological dig in the world right now is in a city you've never heard of. It's in a place also in Egypt called Oxyrhynchus. So now you've heard of two crazy cities in the ancient world, Nag Hammadi, where our friend Muhammad Ali found the Gospel of Thomas, and Oxyrhynchus. Okay, Oxyrhynchus is a city in the ancient Roman world that thrived and then was lost in the sands of Egypt for 1,000 years, and no one knew where the lost city of Oxyrhynchus was. And then a couple of Oxford scholars in 1897, 1898, went looking for the lost city of Oxyrhynchus, something like Raiders of the Lost Ark, and they found it. And when they found the lost city of Oxyrhynchus, not only did they find the city, but they found the dumping ground for old manuscripts. They found the garbage heap for old manuscripts in the lost city of Oxyrhynchus, which contains thousands upon thousands upon thousands upon thousands of ancient manuscripts. Not just of the Bible, of just about everything you can imagine. Greco-Roman works, Greek literature, poetry. We've got what are called documentary papyri, which are, you know, private letters, receipts, and bills of sale, and things like this. And we also have biblical texts. And what we found in Oxyrhynchus is a explosion of New Testament manuscripts and Old Testament manuscripts, too. And do you realize that that archaeological dig is still active now in 2026, having started in 1898, and it is still an active archaeological dig. They are still publishing and discovering manuscripts today. In fact, any given year, you can go and pull off the shelf, if your library is sophisticated enough to have it, a volume called the Oxyrhynchus Papyri, which will give you a look at what the latest discoveries are at Oxyrhynchus. And every now and then, and not every now and then, almost every year, there's new copies of the New Testament. A new copy from John, new copy from Romans, another text of Galatians, something from 1 Thessalonians. My students ask me all the time, if they're still discovering biblical manuscripts, why am I not hearing about this on the news? Why is this not on TV? I tell them, I was like, well, I'll tell you why. Because every time they find, let's say, a new copy of Luke, it looks pretty much like every other copy of Luke. And it doesn't really change anything materially. I said, do you think if they found a copy of Luke that was radically different than every other copy of Luke, you think you'd hear that on the evening news? The answer is absolutely. So in this sense, no news is good news. This is happening behind the scenes. You don't even know it. And the reason it doesn't make the news is because it doesn't change anything. The text is so predictably stable that every new copy, for the most part, tells us what we already knew from every other copy we already had. Here's another thing to take away about the quantity of manuscripts. Not only does this position us well to evaluate our New Testament, but almost certainly guarantees that the original text is somewhere in that collection. Remember, what's the big concern about textual criticism? The big concern is, what if we had the words of the New Testament that were lost? What if they got changed and we can't get back to what they originally said? Well, if I only had one copy of Luke, I could really be concerned about that, because that one copy may be good or may be bad. I have no way to know what the original might have said. But if I have thousands of copies of the New Testament, there's a lot of confidence that in that repertoire, in that cachet of literature, is the original text. And I can be absolutely sure it's in there and recoverable. And that's exactly, as I'll show in a moment, what we do find. One more observation about quantity before we leave it. And this is something that's often overlooked. Here's what's interesting about the New Testament. Every time you find a new manuscript, you know what you also find? New textual variations. Because every time you find a new manuscript, you get to observe just more scribal mistakes. And by the way, I'll get to the scribal mistakes in a moment, but scribes made mistakes just like everybody makes mistakes. They were just doing their job, and if you copied that many books, you'd make mistakes too. I guarantee you, if I gave you one paragraph to copy tonight in a handwritten way, you'd make multiple mistakes in one sitting with one paragraph you may not even realize. The scribes did a fantastic job, as we'll discover, but they did make scribal variations, just like anybody would in the ancient world. And every new manuscript we discover gives you an opportunity to know more scribal variations. And this brings us back to Ehrman's number. He says there's 200,000 to 400,000 textual variants. He may well be right about the number, but that number doesn't mean anything until you realize something. The only reason the number is so high for the New Testament is because we have so many more manuscripts than any other book in antiquity. And every new manuscript is a new opportunity to count up more textual variants. If I had Tacitus's Roman history and I have three copies, how many textual variants am I going to have? Only three copies worth. Does that mean it's more reliably copied? No, it doesn't have 5,700 copies to compare. The more copies you have, the more discovery of textual variants. And so what should be good news is turned around by Ehrman to make it look like it's bad news. And that's what's frustrating about this. The only reason we have this many variants isn't because our scribes are bad at their job. The reason we have this many variants is because we just know about so many more variants because we have so many more copies. This is a really critical thing that makes these statistics just start to melt away. And there's another thing I'll tell you in a minute that really makes them melt away. Okay, first of our three, quantity of New Testament manuscripts. Let's move on to a second here, which is the date. When are these manuscripts dated? Now, by the way, important distinction to make. In the prior lecture, I talked about dating, but I talked about dating in terms of the publication of a book. Mark was written, say, in the 60s. John was maybe written in the 80s or 90s. Okay, that's the date of the book's writing. We're not talking about that here. We're talking about the date of the manuscript of that book. So you might have a lot of copies, but the question is, how close do those copies get to the time of publication? Now, a good way to analyze this is to go back to our buddy Tacitus, who's the Roman historian you've been talking about. We don't have that many copies of Tacitus's work in terms of total quantity, but now we're going to ask a second question about his work. How early are those copies? It was written, Roman history was written about 100 AD. Do we have a copy of Tacitus from, say, 200 AD? Nope. Do we have a copy of Tacitus from 300 AD? I wish. No. 400 AD. 500 AD. No. 600 AD. No. 700 AD. No. 800. No. Our earliest copy of Roman history is from the 9th century. It's 800 years after Tacitus wrote his book. Our first glimpse at the text in history is 800 years later after he wrote it. Now, you might think, and you ought to think, wow, that's a pretty big gap. How do I know that the thing I'm looking at in the 8th century is actually what Tacitus wrote in the 1st century? have 800 years to account for there. And I don't even have that many copies to compare to one another. I don't see scholars walking around thinking, well, no one knows what Tacitus says. Not a lot of skepticism there, but nonetheless, you think that's a pretty big problem to have that kind of gap. And by the way, that kind of gap is pretty normal. The average gap for a document from the first century to our earliest copy is somewhere between 500 and 1,000 years. And no one in the world of antiquities even shrugs at that. They're like, well, yeah, that's just the way the world works. I already said we don't get that many copies of things, and we certainly don't get many old copies. How about the New Testament? What's the oldest copy we have of the New Testament? Believe it or not, the New Testament was written in the first century. We've already established that. Our earliest copies go all the way back to the second century. This is stunningly early. In fact, I just published an article this year. It just came out actually in November in a chapter of a series of invited essays and a chapter in a book on the second century. And my task was to analyze all the possible second century manuscripts of the New Testament. And as I was writing that chapter, I was just amazed that we have any second century manuscripts of the New Testament. It is remarkable to have a glimpse at the text that early. And we have not just like one or two, we have all kinds of different books accounted for in the second century. John is by far the most popular. We've got quite a bit of Matthew. We have other kinds of books floating around, Revelation, and we can get a glimpse at a decent number of books in the New Testament as early as the second century. You know what we find? Pretty much the same text we have now. A good example of this is a manuscript by the name of Papyrus 66. P66 is one of our earliest copies of the Gospel of John. It's late 2nd, probably early 3rd, so it's slightly out of the 2nd century, but right around 200 AD. And it's a remarkable copy because it's almost complete. It's almost the entire Gospel of John from 200 AD. By the way, you can go online and look at photographic facsimiles of this now. You can literally flip through the pages of P66 on your screen. It's all in Greek, of course, but you're looking at a 2nd century, 3rd century manuscript. You can just flip through the pages. And so I have a class at RTS I teach on the origins of the New Testament canon where one of my assignments is I give them high-definition photographs of some of the pages out of P66, and we read it together as a class. So they're not just reading John. They're reading one of the very earliest copies of John we have. And here's the other thing remarkable about P66. P66 doesn't just have almost all the gospel. It has the very first page. It has the prologue. Every word of it. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. One of the things that we learn about ancient manuscripts in the early Christian world is this isn't something that, this would be intuitive if you think about it, is when a manuscript gets damaged, okay, and it's in the form of a book, a codex. When an ancient book gets damaged, what pages are lost first? The beginning and the end, right? It's common because those are the outer pages. Think about it. If you have a book you like to take around in your backpack and you stuff it in your backpack and take it out of your backpack, you know, 50 times a year, what pages do you lose first? Not the middle pages. You lose the pages at the beginning or the pages at the end. So a lot of the copies we have of our Gospels are missing the beginning and the end naturally, right? That's not surprising. But this manuscript has the opening page. It's amazing. Every year when my students read it with me, their response is always the same because we're done reading it, and they're like, this is exactly the same Greek as it is in our Bibles now. And I'm like, yeah, that's kind of the point. It hasn't substantively changed. It's the same exact thing. And if you were to read it, you would be like, wow, this is from 200 AD and is substantively identical. So, what we have in the New Testament, there's not only 5,700 manuscripts, but many which are early. Now, many which are late, too. The vast majority of our manuscripts are medieval. Don't mistake, because that's where the scriptorium's cranked up. We have a lot of manuscripts from the 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th century. Okay, of course, we would expect that, because those are more recent, and that's when we produce a lot of these. But the fact that we can reach as far back as the 2nd is stunning. By the way, you may not realize that the oldest New Testament manuscript we have is also a copy of the Gospel of John, and it's what's known as Papyrus 52. P52 is still considered the earliest copy of any New Testament book, and dated right around 125 AD, but usually the dating goes in 50-year increments, so it's roughly dated 100 to 150, and was discovered in Egypt, even though John was written in Ephesus. What's interesting about P52 is, if you think about it, let's say John was written in 90 AD, which is a pretty reasonable date, and P52 is written between 100 and 150. Now you've got a document that's maybe within 25 years of its original production, or maybe 50 years of its original production. I don't know of any document of antiquity that gives you a glimpse of a text that early, close to when it was written. If you're ever traveling in the UK and you get near Manchester, England, you can go see P52. It's in what's called the John Rylands Library at the University of Manchester. You can go in there and you can look at it. It's like now a tourist attraction. They've kind of made a big deal of it, so that if you go into the John Rylands little bookstore at the end, there's all these little postcards with an image of P52 on it that you can send home to your friends. Look what I saw, P52, right? And you can, like, you know, hang it on the wall or put it on your fridge or whatever. But it's a big tourist attraction because it's still the earliest New Testament text we have. So this is something that maybe you want to do next time you're there. What's the point? Here's the point, is that now that we have a lot of manuscripts, more than any other document in antiquity, we have the earliest glimpse. We can get all the way back to the second century, and when we get back to the second century, the text looks substantively the same as it does now. All right, that leads us to the third and final thing I want to talk about here, which is the quality of the manuscripts. We talked about quantity, we talked about date, and now we're going to talk about quality. A couple different things I want to explore under this last heading. First is, let's talk about those changes again, 200 to 400,000. Let's assume those numbers are accurate, and I don't have any reason to doubt them. I already gave you a reason to think those numbers don't nearly mean what you think they do, by virtue of the fact that we only know that many variants because we have so many manuscripts, more than any other document. So in one sense, that number is somewhat meaningless because it's only inflated by virtue of how successful we are in acquiring New Testament manuscripts. But there's another reason why that number is not that meaningful, because of the kind of variants. When someone talks about variants, we tend to get really nervous. We think, oh my gosh, this is a different story. This is a different account. This is a different Jesus. You know, in one gospel, Jesus rises from the dead, and the other one he doesn't, or something like this. Right? We're talking about, so we think, massive changes. But actually, that's not the case. What makes up the vast, vast majority of these 200,000-plus changes? When I say vast majority, I'm talking about upwards of 75 or 80% of all textual variants. We know that almost all these textual variants are basically accounted for as spelling mistakes. Changes in what's called orthography in the ancient world. So orthography is just a fancy word for differences of spelling. And by the way, not just spelling mistakes, because scribes did make spelling mistakes, but spelling variations. It's very common to have spelling variations in the ancient world. So can you imagine that a massive chunk of these textual variations is not only accounted for by the number of manuscripts, but also by the fact that almost all of them, about 75 or 80% of them, are basically spelling differences, all of which count as a textual variant in the manuscript tradition. I don't know if you've thought much about a spelling variation, but spelling variations sometimes can affect the text meaningfully, but most of the time you don't even notice they're there. And most of the time when you have a spelling variation, you actually fix it in your head intuitively. This is why when my students proofread their papers, even with spell check, I always get spelling errors. Like, how is this happening? Because when they proofread it, I don't know how they missed the spell check thing, but when they proofread it, they just intuitively fix it in their minds, which is why you always need someone else to proof your paper, right? Because you know what's coming, in a sense, and you don't see it on the way. But no one looks at a spelling mistake and then thinks the whole thing is rubbish as a result. I'll give you an example of this that I think brings this home. I was, years ago, back when my kids were younger, they're all out of the house now, but back when my kids were younger, you know, I would do the traditional go into the bedroom and tuck them in at night scenario. So one night I went into my son's room to say goodnight. And all my kids are avid readers, and my son was in the middle of this book. And he goes, Dad, he goes, I found a spelling mistake in this book. And I'm thinking to myself, no, you didn't. And he's like, no, I did. And this book is one of the best-selling books in all of the history of the English-speaking world. Maybe hundreds of millions of copies have been sold of this book. And he's reading this book, and I'm thinking to myself, as you know, in my back, I didn't say this out loud, I'm thinking in the back of my head, do you know how many times editors have been over this book? You know how many print runs this book has had? You know how many times this thing has been on the shelf? There's no way in the world you found a spelling error. So I said, let me see it. I was getting ready to tell my 12-year-old or whatever he was at the time, see, it's not a spelling error. You know what? He was right. He found a mistake in this book. Looking back on it now, I kind of wish we had written to the editor or the publisher saying, hey, you know, should we get like an award for this or something? Some sticker, some free book, some, you know, cup of coffee? I don't know. Give me something here. Because that was like, wow, this thing is really an error. And I can't remember if it was like there versus there. You know how it could be T-H-E-I-R versus T-H-E-R-E versus T-H-E-Y apostrophe R-E. Maybe it was something like that. It was a legitimate mistake. And I told my son, I was like, well done, you know. And then I took the book and threw it in the trash and said, now you don't know anything about what it says. No, that's not what I did, right? Because one spelling error, even lots of spelling errors, doesn't change the meaning of the story. You don't look at a story and say, well, if there's a spelling mistake, well, then I can't know what it says. Here's what you realize, and it's not just spelling mistakes. In my book, Heresy of Orthodoxy, which I guess I heard maybe some people had read here, I have a whole chapter on this where I talk about how it's not just spelling variations. There's also different aspects of the way Greek works that you can have variations that don't change the meaning at all. And a lot of these things are bound up in that. What that means is that when you whittle all the sort of meaningful and viable variants down, we're talking about a 1% here of even worthy of discussion. So what looked like this massive, scary, hundreds of thousands of variants technically is true. They're there. But what's not true is whether they actually change anything and whether they actually challenge the viability of the New Testament. But there's more to say about quality than this. Here's the other thing you may not realize about the quality of our New Testament manuscripts is there's lots of evidence for very professional book production. I've also written on this in other places, and I can't say it all tonight, but let me mention a number of things that scholars have begun to discover about the early Christian manuscripts that have really been encouraging. One is what we call the scribal hand, the handwriting itself. It used to be thought that Christian scribes are kind of lousy at their job and didn't do a very good job. Well, that's before we started discovering a lot of Christian manuscripts, but once we just started discovering more and more Christian manuscripts, we realized, wait a second, these are really impressive pieces of work. They're calligraphic. They're beautiful, they're formal, clearly done by a professional scribe. So the scribal hands of a lot of these manuscripts is actually quite impressive. Here's a second thing to note about the quality of our Christian scribes, is they all adopted the same book format in a surprising way. One of the things that you may not realize is that when Christianity was born in the ancient world, everybody that was writing literary works were all using what was called a scroll, okay, or what we call a roll. You know, roll is what you see where you wind up each end of the book and you only have writing on one side of the page. And so the Jews were using rolls. The Greco-Roman world was using rolls. Everybody's using rolls. And then along comes this upstart thing called Christianity. You know what they do? They don't use rolls. You're like, what? They use what's called a codex. What's a codex? It's where you fold the page in half and you bind it at the spine. You can read on both sides of the page now rather than just on one side of the page. By the way, every time you open your Bibles, guess what you're opening? A codex. Talk about winning the world. The codex took over the whole world in such a way that basically everybody uses the codex and will never stop. It is the ultimate book production format. In fact, it was so dominant in the early Christian world that it used to be thought that Christians invented the codex. Did you know that? Early scholars thought, this is so amazing. Christians are using the codex earlier than anyone else. They're using it all over the place. They're using it ubiquitously. They must have invented it. Well, it turns out they didn't invent it. But here's what's amazing about it. In spite of their Jewish heritage and the Greco-Roman heritage, they said, we're going to use our own distinctive book format. This has been a stump for scholars. They're like, what can explain this amazing thing that Christians are doing, so countercultural in every way? Lots of theories out there that can try to explain why Christians preferred the codex. Before I even mention what those might be, though, the observation I want to point out to you is the fact that they were so uniformly doing it everywhere. In fact, it's so dominant, we can hardly find a single copy of the New Testament anywhere across our 5,700 that's not on a codex. All the second century ones on codices, as far back as we can see. Every geographical location, all over the place, is codex, codex, codex. So what I always ask is, did someone send out a memo? How do you do that? How do you get every Christian doing the same thing? This is remarkable unity. This suggests a very sophisticated and networked scribal infrastructure, okay? So you have very good scribal hand with a very networked and developed scribal infrastructure. This suggests that Christian scribes are not flying by the seat of their pants going, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to do these things. I don't know how to read. No, they seem to actually know what they're doing. And we have every reason to think they did a really good job of it. Here's a third thing I'll mention about Christian scribes, is that they would correct their work. One of the things about that document, P66, that I mentioned a minute ago that my students read, is that the first scribe would come in and write the text, and then what looks like another scribe would go in as a corrector and proof it. And when they would proof the text, sometimes they would catch mistakes that the first scribe had. So scribes were very meticulous about their work, very careful, very conscientious. And they would go back and correct the work and make sure it was right, and they would go over it meticulously. This suggests probably an early version of what's called a scriptorium, right, which is an official scribal sort of place where copying happens at a very developed and intentional level. This sort of write a book and then check a book and correct a book is the kind of thing you want to be happening when you want to know that those books are copied carefully. By the way, the job of the scribe was so brutally hard in the ancient world. I don't know if you know this, but as in a lot of the manuscripts we have, the scribes would make marginal comments in the margins that were just kind of random, that you could tell were made sort of like just off, kind of like you would doodle on your bulletin at church, and they would never do that, of course, never doodle on the bulletin, but you'd write on the bulletin. Well, scribes would do that. Every once in a while they would write up something like, my back hurts, I'm getting tired. The scribal job was hard. And then scribes would sometimes talk back and forth to each other in the margins. So one scribe would do something, and another scribe would say, stop changing the text. And they would sort of, say stuff. You can tell there's a system here. They're talking to each other. They're interacting with each other. If you wanted to be a scribe in the ancient world, that was brutal. It was tough on the eyes. We don't have the, glasses and reading glasses. It was tough with the pen. It was backbreaking work for thousands of words that you'd have to copy over time. When you look at the collective work of our scribes, it is stunning how incredibly good a job they do. Does that mean every individual manuscript's good? No, we have some manuscripts that are lousy. That scribe is just not a good scribe. Fair enough. When you have thousands of manuscripts and thousands of scribes, you're going to come across some bad ones. But the collective witness of our manuscripts is incredibly solid. Okay, and as a whole, our scribal infrastructure was sophisticated and professional. Okay, so where does that leave us? We've talked about three things. Quantity of the manuscripts. We have more than any other document in the ancient world. It's not even close, which means that we know the original text is in there, and we can compare these copies, and that explains why we have so many variants. The date of the manuscripts. There's no other document from the first century that gives you a glimpse of the text in the second century. Are you kidding me? Nothing gets you that close, and when you look at it, it's remarkably consistent. And then the quality of the manuscripts. Most of the changes are either spelling variations or other changes that don't affect the meaning of the text. And we have a lot of evidence for a sophisticated scribal infrastructure, including the scribal hands, the codex book format, and possible evidence of early scriptoriums. So much more to say. I just released a book. This one's not going to make it on your shelf probably, but I just released a book in this past summer with Oxford University Press on early Christian manuscripts. And it was it's actually on early Christian miniature manuscripts called miniature codices. In case you're wondering, how to get a copy? Let me just tell you, it's $110 a copy. Ouch, right? Oxford, when it sells us academic books, does not go easy on you, and it's not made for sort of popular consumption. Basically, they sell it to major research libraries and a few scholars, and everyone else just looks at it online. Okay, fair enough. But in that book, when I wrote it, I was just stunned again at how textually oriented the early Christian world was. These were not amateurs. These people knew about books, they understood books, and they did a good job of copying their books. Okay, let me open up here for Q&A. I said I would do that for paper number two or session number two. We do welcome you just to raise your hand, speak loud, and I'll repeat it for the microphone for the recording. Yep, right here. Okay, I figured this would be the first question. So the question was, can I comment on the two significant textual variants we know about in the New Testament, which would be the long ending of Mark 16:9-20, and what's known as the story of Jesus and the adulterous woman, which is the end of Mark 7 and John 7 and the beginning of John 8. So one of the things that's interesting about misquoting Jesus is that, so rather than talk about how the vast majority of textual variants are spelling errors, Ehrman spends a ton of time on these two texts. And it's not surprising why, because they're famous and also because they're longer, and it's easy to rattle people's cages with these sorts of examples. A couple of things to note about those textual variants. One is, those are the only two sizable textual variants in the entire New Testament textual witness. So when you think about how many books, how many stories, how many texts, and how many copies, what are some meaningfully sized textual variants? You have a grand total of two, which is the longing of Mark and the story of Jesus and the adulterous woman, which is a pretty good track record. Aside from that, we actually have really good evidence about these textual variants and why we know they're not there in the original manuscripts. You may wonder why they still appear in many of our English Bibles. If you have an English Bible, they'll appear in brackets, and usually it'll say something like, our earliest manuscripts don't have these copies. Part of the reason they're in most English Bibles now has to do with the history of the King James Version, which dominated the English-speaking world for so long, that leaving these out now is probably something most publishers aren't going to do, so they stick it in there and they leave it in brackets. But there's really good evidence that these were not original, and here's the thing that I always remind people of. If you know they're not original, then the change doesn't change the reliability of the New Testament text. Like, if someone made a big change, but I can spot it, well, it doesn't matter how big the change is. The fact is, I can spot it. If I can spot it, I can get us back to the original text, right? What would be concerning is if we had a big change and couldn't spot it. Then we'd be like, well, now I have a big change, and I didn't know it was a big change. Okay? But if I can see someone did a change somewhere, but I can see that it happened, then I think it takes away the concern one might have over it. If you want more on this, I wrote an article for Ligonier Ministries Table Talk magazine years ago, where the whole article was about the story of Jesus and the adulterous woman and the longing of Mark. And I talk about those stories, why we don't think they're original, and what impact it has on things like inerrancy. Great question. Normal question. Yeah, right here.
Yeah, looking to what you're covering this evening.
Yeah. All right, so if I understood your question, I'll repeat it for the recording. You're asking, okay, we're making a case tonight for the trustworthiness of the Bible. Is that still being upheld in major Christian schools and seminaries? Is that essentially your question?
Essentially, yes.
Yeah,
and
okay.
Then flowing down to the pulpits.
Yeah, well, yeah, and if it's not being held up there, yeah. So I think there's good news and bad news here. Whenever I say, if there's good news and bad news, which do you want first? It's always, well, give me the bad news first, right? So the bad news is that there are pockets, and in some places substantive pockets, of institutions, seminaries or colleges, that have Christian heritages, Christian names, that are not sticking with the historic view of Scripture as inspired and inerrant. That's true. And is that affecting denominations and pulpit preaching? Absolutely. And so we know certain denominations, we can see trends and slides and directions that we would probably be concerned about. And that's not new. That's old. There's the 20th century sort of, early 20th century sort of fundamentalist controversy, which that term isn't what you think it means. But it was basically a debate over some of these things that hasn't really ended. And a lot of the mainline, main denominational changes have been around exactly these things. So that's still going on, and it is a concern, and that's certainly not good news. But there's lots of good news. And when I say lots of good news, what I mean is when I look at the evangelical landscape across the United States, and really even globally, at least in the English-speaking world, which I'm more up to speed on, obviously, I'm actually really encouraged by a number of solid institutions that are growing, that are cranking out good men and women who love God's word and uphold these things and teach these things faithfully. And I think you've seen a good resurgence of some of this in certain quarters. I think preaching is as respected now as it's been in a while. I think there's probably really good reasons to think that the book publishing side of evangelicalism is as strong as it's been in a while. So I think there's a lot of reasons to take heart. So be encouraged by some good trends. Pray for the trends that aren't good. But I think, no matter where you are in history, is always kind of a mixed bag out there. And so you always got to be aware, okay, if I want to go to a seminary or Bible college, let me make sure I'm going to one that teaches what I think it's teaching. That would be a good piece of advice I think I would give anyone who thinks about those places. Great question. Yeah, over here. Yeah, so you obviously have been doing your reading there. If you didn't catch the question, he's asking, okay, look, we're talking about manuscripts and dating. What about manuscripts like P137 that was purported to be a first century manuscript and turned out not to be? I'll give you that story in a second. And then do we have any other viable, possible first century manuscripts? So first, just a general comment on manuscripts in the first century. Obviously, if you have documents written in the first century, it would be a dream of dreams to find a manuscript from the first century of any New Testament text. I mean, I can't tell you how incredible and crazy early that would be. That's such a dream thing that the chances are just so low that we would ever find it. But it's possible. It could happen, right? You never know what you're going to find in the sands of wherever. So certainly possible. Do I think we'll ever find a first century manuscript of any New Testament text? No, because I think that the way manuscripts' survival rates are, the fact that we find anything in the second is stunning. The fact that we find anything in the first century is probably very unlikely. Do we have any current candidates that are maybe first century manuscripts? No. Do I expect to find any, as I said? Probably no. He did mention the story of Papyrus 137, which wasn't called 137 at the time. That only got the Gregory Alon number in recent times. But a number of years ago, it was mentioned that we may have a first century copy of Mark. And this made the rounds on the internet and on social media and in some public speaking engagements where people had mentioned it. And so it began sort of the rumor mill of we might have a first century Mark. And the people who were telling us that we had a first century Mark said we have good grounds for thinking it's first century from very highly respected papyrologists. Well, the unfortunate way of releasing that information like that is it gets everyone all sort of churned up about it. And they're like, oh, finally we got a first century manuscript. And then guess what? When it was finally published, you think it was first century? No, it was third century. And what looked like a wonderful sort of grab of new evidence just kind of evaporated in your hands. So what's the lesson there? I think the lesson there is, you know, wait till the publication comes out to say anything about it, till you know what you know, and you don't know what you think you know until you know it. That would certainly be part of the application. The other part of the application is I don't think we should get too worked up about early texts. Our the truth of the New Testament does not hinge on finding a first century manuscript. It just doesn't. We have so much good evidence right now. We don't, in a quote, need anything else to be sure that what we have is trustworthy. Would I like a first century manuscript? In principle, who wouldn't? But I think one of the dangers of apologetics is that we can sort of grab a hold of things in ways that maybe always aren't consistent with the historical data, and it makes us look a little desperate. Like, oh, if we only had that, if the Shroud of Turin was only original, if the ossuary of James is really his bone box, and then we you give the impression that once you get all that, then you have grounds for believing. No, we already have it. We have tons of reasons to believe. We don't need those things to be valid in order to believe. Whether they're valid or not is interesting to debate, and you can debate those things, but we don't need that. So that's my quick take on Papyrus 137, which I think is an interesting story. I'm glad that we have it, though, because it's still one of the earliest complete copies, or not complete, one of the earliest fragments of Mark we have, late 2nd, early 3rd century. Yes.
I believe there are some Christian scholars, theologians, who would argue that just like we have a closed canon, we have a closed manuscript tradition. If there's a received text, then we shouldn't keep looking for the critical text that is closer to the original. Can you briefly kind of say, is there any basis for why they think that, and then respond to it?
Yeah, great question. So this question has to do with what's called the textus receptus. You didn't use that term, use the English version of it, received text. So there's a movement within evangelicalism that some of you may know about that argues that when it comes to establishing the original text of the New Testament, that rather than looking at the earliest manuscripts that we can find to work our way back to the original text, the better way is to look at the church's broad reception of a Greek text at one moment in time and treat that reception of that text at one moment in time as a definitive church move that says, yes, we recognize this is the God-given text. If you're wondering, well, what time would that be where the church did that? Well, the Textus Receptus people take that as the early 17th century or late 16th century. So basically late 1500s, early 1600s, the King James was published, of course, but the King James has an underlying Greek text known as the Textus Receptus, the received text in English, and it was seen by many as sort of the definitive moment where the Greek text could be seen and grabbed and affirmed. And they think, why are we still tinkering with it when we have that great text then? Why do we have to still look for early manuscripts and so forth? So that movement's out there, and sort of it has different names. Some call it a King James-only movement, which really has to do with more about the Textus Receptus than the King James English translation. I think if you ask why I'm not convinced by that, I think part of it is probably self-evident in the way I've described the view, which is when we ask what moment of frozen time do I take a Greek text and say that's the one that God has for us, well, the only reason I would freeze it in 1610 is if I thought something happened in 1610 that made me think that was the moment. But I don't know anything in 1610 that makes me think that. And certainly, unless we're Roman Catholic, we don't think the church makes some infallible declaration about the text. So that certainly isn't there available to us. What text am I looking for as an evangelical? I'm looking for the original text. I want to know what John wrote when John wrote. If John's inspired, I care what John wrote. If Mark was inspired, I care what Mark wrote. So I don't really want to know what 16th century people necessarily thought, although that's a piece of the puzzle. I want to know what those authors originally wrote when they penned it under the inspiration of the Spirit. How do I assess that? I think the best way to assess that is look at the collective manuscript evidence that gives us the best glimpse we can of the first century, state of the first century text. And that, I think, is what we have now in the critical Greek editions. Long answer, I know, a long debate. If you want something more on this debate, you could read the King James Only Controversy by James White, which is a good summary of the debate, and I think he does a good job for explaining why he doesn't take the text of Receptus as the sort of ultimate moment in time when the Greek text is solidified. So, all right, maybe one more question as we wrap up the night. Yes.
Can you address deconstructing Christianity? That seems to be the contemporary term in terms of almost relativizing everything based on the pinhead of an individual's not standing on their soapbox. And then rewriting the Bible, basically, and the tenets from their own perspective in an age of individualism.
Yeah, yeah. So for the recording, the question was about the whole trend of deconstruction, and I'll add another term, deconversion, that's happening today in the church, and what do I make of that in terms of, how does that exemplify sort of people's individualistic tendencies and so on. So I think the way to answer that is to distinguish between two different kinds of deconstruction. And I actually have written about this on my website. This is a sidebar. I have a website. If you want to read more on canon and text and reliability stuff in sort of bite-sized chunks, I've created a website many years ago for this. My wife, Melissa, told me, she goes, hey, love that you're writing these books, but not everyone's going to want to read your books. And I'm like, okay. Our joke in the family, if you don't know my wife Melissa, she's written more books than I have. Our joke in the family is that I write books and she writes books that people read. Okay, so, but she goes, but if you want to get this stuff out in bite-sized chunks, then you need to put it out in bite-sized. So I started my website. It's called Canon Fodder, which, by the way, is a pun, C-A-N-O-N, right? Not C-A-N-N-O-N. Of course, you have to explain puns. They're not funny anymore. But Canon Fodder is the name of the website. I have a bunch of stuff on there, and I've written about this there. Different kinds of deconstruction. One bad, one good. Some people find themselves in Christian, I'll start with the good. Some people find themselves in Christian spaces where they realize this is not a healthy Christian space. Okay? And there's some, and I'm not talking right versus left here. Whether you can be unhealthy on the right, unhealthy on the left, where there's stuff happening that's unethical or bad, or certain versions of Christianity that have unhealthy trends. And one version of deconstruction that I think is fun is people realizing I've seen parts of evangelicalism that need to be reformed. Parts of evangelicalism need to be thought through better. We need to do better on X or do better on Y. And there's room for any part of Christ Church to always ask, hey, where's the log in my eye? Where can we do better as a church? If I were to ask everybody in this room tonight, you look at evangelicalism in America, where are we strong? Where are we weak? What do we need to do better? So the good part of deconstruction is saying, there's some blind spots we have as evangelicals. Let's do better. Sometimes people use the term deconstruction for that. I don't really think that's the best term for it. Okay, I think that's effectively what Martin Luther did. He looked at the church and go, guys, this is a mess. And everyone wagged their finger at Luther and said, you hate the church. And Luther's like, no, I love the church. That's why I'm bringing up the problems. I want it to change. Okay, so next time someone critiques the church and you say, well, you must hate the church, remember Luther did that. The issue isn't whether you critique the church. The issue is whether your critique is accurate. Okay? So that's the thing to keep in mind. Now, on to the bad deconstruction. The bad deconstruction, I think, was the main tenor of your question, is there some people that basically have deconverted away from Christianity or have changed their definition of Christianity so much that it's not Christianity anymore. Okay? And they basically are saying, Christians this, don't make Christianity doesn't make sense, Christianity is incoherent, Christianity is bad, and so I've got to change it or abandon it or sort of show its holes and weaknesses as invalid as a system. That is all over the place today. And what we have is a lot of people who used to be evangelicals deconvert out of evangelicalism and then spend their whole career critiquing evangelicalism. And there's people on the internet do this. There's people who have whole lives now set up as ex-evangelicals. That's the term, right? Where I'm gonna sort of point out everything that I don't like about evangelicalism. I think that's obviously a very disturbing trend. I think it probably says a lot about their own background that they can't just move on. They have to make a whole career out of attacking Christianity. Does that speak to sort of a culture that's obsessed with individualistic takes on things and so forth? Probably. But that's not new. We've always been a culture of individualism, so that's hardly a new phenomenon. But it's just a more public phenomenon now. When people deconvert 20 years ago, you just didn't hear about it. Because 20 years ago, there was no mechanism to push out their deconversion message. Now there is. So we just have to deal with it more. All that said, though, about the negativity of that, and it is negative, we probably need to do a better job of interacting with people who are deconverting and trying to listen to their story, understand what things they may bring up that have some validity to them, and then try to compassionately persuade them of the truth of Christianity again. So it's tricky. But that's obviously a negative trend, and we'd want to be very careful about it. But I think there's a positive version out there, too. Okay, that's probably up to the bottom of the clock. Thank you, everyone. Sunday school's at 8:45? Okay, maybe I'll see you in the morning. Thank you. All right.